Following are comments on Shakespeare's Henry IV, Part 2, Act 5, including the epilogue and final reflections. They flock together in consent like so many wild geese. Falstaff watches Shallow interacting with his servants, so that he will be able to regale Prince Hal with funny stories, but he also makes ungenerous comments about his old friend. In Act 5, Scene 1, Falstaff, invited to dinner at Justice Robert Shallow's home, watches how his old friend interacts with Davy the servant, and when Shallow leaves, the knight ponders why people act as they do, how they pick up their character, their habits, and so forth. In an era that leans on the four humors to explain a great many things about human behavior, it's refreshing to see our resident proto-sociologist, Sir John Falstaff, ascribing much human behavior to something like an Aristotelian notion of imitation. He says of Shallow and his serving men's mutual actions and interactions that, quote-unquote, their spirits are so married in conjunction with the participation of society that they flock together in consent like so many wild geese. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 58 through 60. Falstaff continues more generally, quote-unquote, it is certain that either wise bearing or ignorant carriage is caught as men take diseases one of another. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 64 through 65. The point of this musing is less sociological, however, than self-serving, as Sir John proposes to use the sights and sounds of Shallow and Company to make Prince Hal laugh. He seems to think Hal is an easy mark when it comes to humor, saying, quote-unquote, oh, it is much that a lie with a slight oath and a jest with a sad brow will do with a fellow that never had the ache in his shoulders. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 70 through 72. The references here are a little obscure, but the idea seems to be that young and inexperienced people are easily impressed when it comes to wit and humor. No prince nor peer shall have just cause to say, God shorten Harry's happy life one day. The new king, Henry V, convincingly promises the Lord Chief Justice and others that he won't be vindictive or a scofflaw, as they may have feared, but a righteous and mature ruler who honors good counsel. In Act 5, Scene 2, no one knows quite what to expect from the one-time wild child who is now King Henry V. Will he be disposed to settle old grudges in the meanest way, or will he surprise them all, and as he said long ago, set about, quote-unquote, redeeming time when men think least he will. The Lord Chief Justice is the most long-faced among the great men in the court, since he once committed Prince Hal to custody briefly for striking him. All the same, nobody need have worried. King Henry V is the model of patience now, and when the Lord Chief Justice explains why he did as he did, the new monarch approves altogether and reappoints him to his office. Whether this really happened or not, it would be hard to come up with a better illustration of the principle of impartial justice. Henry V also reassures the princes and others present that he is no longer the child that he was, saying, quote-unquote, the tide of blood in me hath proudly flowed in vanity till now. Now doth it turn and ebb back to the sea, where it shall mingle with the state of floods and flow henceforth in formal majesty. Act 5, Scene 2, lines 128 through 132. This use of an oceanic metaphor is a notable way of applying the Renaissance notion that there are almost infinite correspondences between things of various orders, including humanity. In sum, in his own reign, Henry V means to avoid falling into the pattern that gave his father so much trouble, and that he described for his son shortly before his death. As the new King Henry says, quote-unquote, no prince nor peer shall have just cause to say, God shorten Harry's happy life one day. Act 5, Scene 2, lines 143 through 144. There will be no more wars if he can help it with proud members of the nobility who, understandably in his father's case, feel that he owes them his very life and crown. The laws of England are at my commandment. When they hear that King Henry IV has died, Falstaff and Shallow travel to London in a celebratory mood. In Act 5, Scene 3, with Falstaff still visiting Justice Shallow in Gloucestershire, Pistol brings news from court, and as his habit runs, nearly gets into an altercation with Falstaff over the manner of his delivery. The news itself, however, is cause for celebration, as far as Sir John is concerned. He supposes that now, with Hal as king, he himself will have free rein to do as he likes, and declares, quote unquote, "The laws of England are at my commandment." Act 5, Scene 3, line 124. Sir John is wrong about this, and the consequences of his mistake will prove personally devastating. "There hath been a man or two killed about her. Officers arrest the hostess and Doll Tearsheet on a somewhat vaguely backed charge." In Act 5, Scene 4, a pair of officers or beadles are in process of arresting the hostess and Doll Tearsheet. Sinclode describes the rather vague justification as follows, quote unquote, "There hath been a man or two killed about her." Act 5, Scene 4, lines 5 through 6. This seems to apply to both the hostess and Doll, the latter of whom turns the air blue with her cursing. This brief scene amounts to a step-down moment in terms of the play's lower-class characters' expectations of leniency under the rule of Henry V, to say the least, and it contrasts markedly with the jubilation Falstaff expresses when he hears that Henry IV is dead and dear Hal is now king. "I know thee not, old man. Fall to thy prayers." Hal is crowned as King Henry V, but when Falstaff tries to catch his attention, he gets from the new sovereign only a chilling and contemptuous rebuke, and then the Lord Chief Justice commits Falstaff and his party to prison. In Act 5, Scene 5, near Westminster Abbey after the king's coronation, Falstaff hears that Doll Tearsheet is now in prison and vows jauntily, quote unquote, "I will deliver her." Act 5, Scene 5, line 37. But that is not to be. As Falstaff proudly and enthusiastically shouts terms of endearment to his old friend Hal, it is not Hal who responds, but Henry V. This intimidating public figure at first says only, quote unquote, "My Lord Chief Justice, speak to that vain man," but at last is himself provoked to offer some speech to Falstaff that the knight surely wishes he hadn't heard. Act 5, Scene 5, line 42 and following. That speech begins, quote unquote, "I know thee not, old man, fall to thy prayers." Act 5, Scene 5, line 55. It goes downhill from then onwards, as Henry says in purely public and formal vein, quote unquote, "Presume not that I am the thing I was. For God doth know, so shall the world perceive, that I have turned away my former self." Act 5, Scene 5, lines 54 through 56. Henry banishes Falstaff from his presence by a distance of no less than 10 miles, though he promises to grant him a minimal pension to keep him from extreme want, and offers to advance him if he truly reforms. This is definitely not what Falstaff had looked for, and to make matters worse, Justice Shallow starts pestering him about that £1,000 loan he has apparently made. But that's all one for the moment, since the Lord Chief Justice orders Falstaff and his friends off to a prison named the Fleet for the time being, promising only, quote unquote, "I will hear you soon." Act 5, Scene 5, line 90. Prince John likes what he sees and hears of this new dispensation created by his brother Henry. Quote unquote, "I like this fair proceeding of the king's," he says, and adds, quote unquote, "I will lay odds that ere this year expire, we bear our civil swords and native fire as far as France. Act 5, Scene 5, Line 93 and Lines 100 through 103. My fear is your displeasure. The epilogue speaker issues an apology for the present play and promises that another one featuring Sir John Falstaff is yet to come. In the epilogue, the speaker says he can offer three things to cap off the play. The first is a fear, which is simply, he says, the audience's disapproval. It's, quote-unquote, displeasure. The curtsy is easily done, and he considers it a, quote-unquote, duty. And as for the speech, well, that, he says, is no big production. Which is the displeasing play, quote-unquote, that the speaker apologizes for? Would that be Henry IV Part 1? Possibly, since the earlier play had initially caused some consternation by using the name Sir John Oldcastle for the character we now know as Falstaff. The epilogue speaker specifically mentions Oldcastle mainly to cover his bases with the powerful relative who objected to the use of the name. Quote unquote, "For Oldcastle died martyr, and this is not the man." Epilogue, line 28. The speaker goes on to remind the audience that he promised a better play, which he hopes has been the function of the present play, Henry IV Part II. One last consideration is a statement of intent to offer yet another Henry play that will continue the saga of Sir John Falstaff. But we know that Henry V does not actually contain the living Falstaff, only a moving account by the hostess of his last illness and death. The play with the living Falstaff turns out to be The Merry Wives of Windsor, which many critics believe to have been written sometime between Henry IV Part 1 and Henry IV Part 2. The epilogue of Henry IV Part 2 has long held a certain fascination among critics, it seems. No less renowned a critic of Shakespeare than James Shapiro has argued that Shakespeare himself was the epilogue speaker in Henry IV Part 2, and it isn't hard to see why he has put forth that claim. The epilogue does read like the author himself is speaking directly to us. But ultimately, that must remain conjecture. Final reflections on Henry IV, Parts 1 and 2, as a unit. Harold Bloom and a number of other critics are probably right that these two Henry IV plays are more about Falstaff than any other character, or at least about Prince Hal and Falstaff. While a savvy but health-challenged and guilt-burdened Henry IV emerges as an authentic figure in both plays, one whose thoughts on politics and the wages of sin are always worth listening to, he gets remarkably little stage time. Both plays are far more centered on the story arc of Prince Hal's transformation from a risk-taking, free-spirited youth to a majestic young king, and the story arc of Sir John Falstaff, who doesn't so much change as suffer the consequences entailed by Hal's transformation. Hal's story, we might say, is, quote-unquote, comical historical, while the funny man Falstaff's story, ironically, is tragic-tending. By the end of Henry IV, Part 2, Falstaff's spirit is all but crushed, and we can glimpse the final path of psychic devastation and death that the hostess recounts with so much pathos in Act 2, Scene 3, of Henry V. All through both of the Henry IV plays, we see not only the lighter, more upbeat dimensions of Hal and Falstaff, but also the dark side of both men. Even before Hal transforms into Henry V, there are times when he seems to be merely using everyone and everything around him and steeling himself for the abandonment that must come in due time. Hal, Henry V's time, is what we might call royal/providential. He is bent upon redeeming not only himself from charges of irresponsibility and triviality, but also his Lancastrian father, the son of John of Gaunt, from the terrible sin by which he obtained the crown. Falstaff has no providential framework of any sort, as Hal does. He pursues the pleasure principle for all he can get from it. But like Hal, he is at times a user of the people around him. The predatory and mean aspect of Sir John Falstaff that many critics and audiences note in The Merry Wives of Windsor wasn't something Shakespeare made up whole cloth for that play. We can find it in the Henry IV plays as well. This quality is painfully evident in the final act of Henry IV, Part 1, wherein Falstaff, brazenly and seemingly without remorse, tells us that he has allowed his little company of quote-unquote ragamuffins to be shot or quote-unquote peppered to kingdom come. Worse, he has done it for profit. Still, there is something much more to a character for whom even such a corrupt and cynical act can't permanently strip us of our affection for him. In this regard, Harold Bloom seems correct when he says that Falstaff, like Hamlet, exceeds the limitations of the play in which he appears. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Friday, October 24th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.